Ron Pattinson joins me this week to talk about British beer brewing in World War II. This is Beersmith Podcast number 211.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 211, and it's late March 2020. Ron Pattinson joins me this week to talk about British beer brewing in World War II. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brew house controller from Blickman Engineering, available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brew house controller with exact precision and the ultimate in flexibility. Whether integrated or freestanding, the Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and amazing advanced settings. Whatever your setup, the Brew Commander offers precision temperature control with perfect repeatability. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. Order yours today. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith Brewing Software a try. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit, juice, and honey, as well as new Whirlpool op options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Ron Pattinson. Ron is the author of dozens of books on historical beer brewing and runs a blog called Shut Up About Barclay Perkins at barclayperkins.blogspot.com. Today, we're going to discuss his new book on UK brewing during World War II. Ron, it's fantastic to have you back.
Oh, it's always a pleasure talking to you, Brad.
So how are you doing? I understand you just got back less than a week ago, I think, from Thailand, which must have been quite an experience given all the things going on in the world right now.
Yes, it was an incredibly stupid trip to make, actually, looking back on it. were I to be able to go over things again, I might well not have done it. But, you know, it happened. I got back. I seem to be alive. So
did you did you go all the way? Did you just go to Thailand or did you go somewhere else as well?
Well, I had two insane trips. So I went to Brazil. I was down there judging in a beer competition. And then flew back to Amsterdam, had 48 hours in Amsterdam, and then flew out to Thailand. So,
wow. And yeah. I assume the planes probably weren't packed at this point.
No, they were quite full, actually.
Really?
The one on the way out to Thailand wasn't completely full, but it was still 2/3 full. And you could see there were people going out with their families on holiday still, because people didn't quite realize what was going on at that point. But
pretty amazing.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have been on the plane either.
Well, we're glad you're back. You're back and safe in Amsterdam now, right?
Yeah, Brazil was really good fun, though. I really liked it down there.
A lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, I shouldn't say this, but when you do these sort of longer term things, because I've done one before in South America, it's great fun because you get to hang around with a gang of people. So I was there with Martin Cornell a lot of the time, Stephen Beaumont, a couple of other people. This guy I know, Chris, who has a brewery in Chile, but he's Brazilian German, but went to school in Britain, so he's quite English in some ways. He's quite a very interesting guy. So we were just hanging around, you know, having some beers, doing a bit of light judging.
Sounds awesome. Sounds great.
It's nice to know because Martin, I don't get that much chance to hang around with him, so it's quite good fun if you have a few days together.
Yeah. Well, today we're going to discuss your mini book called Blitzkrieg. And yes, it is a beer book about British brewing and World War II, and it's not about German tank tactics, right?
No, well, I should maybe put a section in about that. I could get my son Andrew to write it because he's really into that sort of stuff. That might be quite fun. Yeah. It's about basically about World War II. I mean, mostly about UK brewing, but there are going to be a few little bits about some of the stuff that was going on elsewhere. Where partly because I've got some brewing records from Heineken, so I've got some good figures on Dutch brewing. At least from a fairly important brewery between 1939 and 1943, so that tells quite an interesting story, and sort of you can use that in parallel with what was going on in the UK.
Interesting.
Obviously, it ends in 1943 because they just stopped brewing.
Right. Right. Well, last time I had you on, we actually discussed the drop in production during World War One. We talked about the shortages of supplies, the taxes, and some of the lasting changes that literally carry through to today from what happened in World War One. Can you talk a little bit about maybe how things were during the interwar years between World War One and World War Two?
Remarkably stable. The weird thing is, it took me a while to twig this, but the classes of draft beer and their strengths were pretty much defined by the last set of price legislation at the end of World War One, so in 1921. And that basically set the gravities and the prices for the beers for the whole interwar period. So it was remarkably stable. So basically between 1922 and 1939, nothing much had changed. Right. So you had the same beers, the same prices, the same gravities. So it was all... And it's a reason why I wondered often why there were no beers stronger than 1055. And the reason is because of the last set of price controls. And it was anything above 1055 was a certain price. So it made no sense to brew anything much over 1055 because you'd still only charge the same price for it. And that's why Guinness between the wars is 1055.
I mean, it's kind of interesting. Even during the Roaring Twenties, things didn't really change, and temperance movement here. It didn't change much at all.
No, really, because prices were incredibly stable. They're exactly the same, apart from a brief period when they put up the tax in 1931, which resulted in a disastrous fall in the amount of money they actually collected. So it's quite ironic that they put up the tax and ended up receiving less money than they did if they just left it where it had been.
And of course, you were still on a gold standard then. So I guess imagine prices in general were pretty stable, right?
Yeah, they were. So apart from that between 1922 and 1939, the price of beer didn't change at all. And you had it in sort of strict classes. So it'd be 4p, 5p, 6p, 7p, 8p, 9p a pint.
Right, right. And World War II was vastly different than World War One, though. Can you maybe talk about at a top level what happened to beer during World War Two?
Well, there's a big difference. There's some similarities, but some huge differences. The similarity is obviously that the tax went up a lot. The dissimilarities are that in World War One, nothing much happened apart from the price of beer going up between 1914. And the start of 1917. Strengths go down a little bit, but not very much.
Right.
Then after April 1917, when you're starting to have the German U-boat campaign having a big effect on grain supplies in the UK, then there's suddenly all these big, big cuts in beer, one after another, that go right through until 1919. When you get average beer strength down to 1030, and that's dictated by the government. So it all happens at the end of the war. So for the first few years, nothing much happens apart from the fact the price has gone up.
Right. But in World War II, we saw something quite different, right?
Yeah. So in World War II, what you see is that the average strength of beer goes down between 1939 and 1943, and then it stabilizes. So I've actually got the figures here, so I can tell you exactly what they are. So in... Yeah. Before the war, average gravity was about 1042. Mm-hmm. By 1943, that's down to 1034, but then it stays there until 1945. And for the book, I've been writing lots and lots of recipes. And one of the things I've found out is I have to do a recipe for every single year for every beer because they change every single year. some of it's the gravity, but I've noticed that it's only in the first half of the war that the gravity's full. Then they stabilize for the rest of the war, and then they fall again after the end of the war, and they hit their nadir in 1948, when it was down to just under 1033 average gravity, which is still better than in World War One.
But the overall
effect was average gravity fell from 1042 before the war to 1037 when it stabilized after the war.
A pretty substantial drop. And then another interesting thing, I think, is you saw production actually grow during the war, right?
Yes, and you have to look at it two ways, right? Because they've got the two ways that they used to, for tax purposes, they use this thing called a standard barrel,
right,
which is 36 imperial gallons at 1055. It used to be about average strength when it was introduced, this standard barrel, but it was still being used for tax purposes. So you always have production in what they call bulk barrels, which is the actual volume, and standard barrels. And you see that during World War II, the bulk barrels went from about 25 million at the start of the war to 31.25 by the end of the war. So they went up.
So yeah, that's a pretty substantial growth, actually, considering it's wartime and there's a lot of pressure on everything.
Okay, but if you look at standard barrels, so that takes out the strength of the beer. It tells you really how much alcohol was being produced. That also went up. That went up from 18.75 million to about 19.75 million. So that means that it wasn't just if you take out the drop in gravity, they were still producing more beer in real terms than before the war.
Right. Interesting.
And the peak beer production in terms of standard barrels was 1945, and I don't think it got back to that level until the 1960s.
So, I mean, you actually saw a drop off after the war then production, pretty substantial, I would think.
Yeah. And after the war, it was falling all the way through the 1950s, and they were really worried that people were, you know, going off beer, and it only perked up when I think it was 1959, when there was a tax cut, which is something very rare in British brewing, is when they reduced the tax on beer. And they did that, and then beer production and consumption went up again after that and was increasing during the 60s and early 70s.
Well, let's talk about taxes for a minute. Wars are pretty expensive, and alcohol is often one of the first things to get taxed. How did the British beer taxes change during World War II?
Oh, it's always the first thing during the war.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at the start of the war, I was talking about this standard barrel. It started off the war at 80 shillings, which was the end, what it had been at the end of World War One. So at the start of World War One, it was 7 shillings and 9 pence, and it ended the war at 80 shillings. So it went up about tenfold.
That's a pretty substantial increase, no?
Yeah, it's a pretty substantial increase. In World War II, it went up from 80 shillings to 286 shillings. So that's about quadruple, a little bit less.
Right, but I mean, I assume the price of everything was probably going up during that time too, right?
Well, yes, and people were in employment and wages were good, relatively good. And beer was something which was never rationed.
Interesting. Why was beer never rationed, I guess?
It was never officially rationed.
Yeah.
But the way the trade worked was, because there were limitations on how much they could produce, they rationed each pub to a certain percentage of the beer that they'd taken before the war. I've got loads of circular letters from Barclay Perkins where they're telling all the customers exactly how much Russian stout they can have. And what the limitations are on this, and there are other beers. So there's a lot of stuff, and also begging for the bottles back.
There wasn't rationing, but there were shortages, right?
Yes. So especially, I think, in 1941 and 1942, there seems to have not have been enough beer to go around often. And so pubs would be closing just because they didn't have any stocks. Later on in the war, that doesn't seem to be happening. at least not from what I've seen from newspaper accounts. 41 seems to be the worst. And one of the things they did, because they wanted to cut down the amount of transport, they had this thing called zoning, which meant that breweries which had tight houses more than a certain distance away from their brewery, those pubs would be supplied by another brewery which was closer. So basically, they didn't want people needlessly just shipping beer around the country when there were breweries closer that could provide it. So you see, there's a lot of cases where breweries have got tight houses from someone else that they're supplying, or some of their pubs are being supplied by someone else. So you've got Barclay Perkins at one point brew something called Watney's XLK, which I'm assuming is because they've got some Watney's pubs they were supplying, and they wanted to brew something that was like one of the Watney's beers. It's a very, very interesting period, but it was all about saving fuel. So saving lorries going up and down the country, just shipping beer needlessly.
Makes sense.
It's quite clever.
They're
incredibly well organized in Britain during World War II. If you compare it to the Germans, who were completely useless, it's quite the opposite of what you might have thought. And they were really efficient at using resources in Britain during World War II. And you see that in the recipes of the beers. So they had this bumper oats crop in 1942.
Okay.
So in 1943, all the brewers had to use 15% oats in their beers. And this is another reason why I've done recipes for every single year for most of the beers I've got in the book. It's because the adjuncts keep changing. So you see, at the start of the war, they're using flake maize mostly. That was the one of choice of British brewers. Then you see in the first year of the war, 1940, the first real full year, then they all start using flake rice, weirdly. So obviously they got some rice lying around, and that's what they gave to brewers. Year after that, they're using flake barley because they've really boosted barley production during the war. So they got lots of barley, but they reckon, okay, if you don't malt it, then it's going to use less fuel. If you just flake it, you can still use it. 15%, just replace the flake maize that people used to use. You've saved, you getting it all yourself, not having to import anything, and you're saving fuel.
Interesting. So they're using flaked adjuncts instead of malted just because it's more efficient energy-wise, I guess.
Well, no, but the brewers had always used it. It's just rather than imported maize that was flaked, they were using homegrown barley that was flaked.
Right.
So it's not like they were using more adjuncts. In fact, the percentage of malt that was used went up during the war in beer. Mostly not because of the adjuncts. The adjuncts stayed about the same. It's because they were using less sugar.
So, Ron, what role did Churchill play here? I understand he was supportive of beer.
Yes, well, he was a fairly enthusiastic drinker.
I've heard that.
I don't know if it's true, but the story is he had a half pint of champagne for breakfast every morning, which is pretty classy. Well, I do know that Carlsberg Special Brew was brewed initially for him. And the reason it's strong is they knew what he was like.
Interesting. Which one was that? Which beer?
Carlsberg Special Brew.
Interesting. But he kept brewing going during the war, right? Didn't put a lot of restrictions on it.
He insisted that the troops get beer because he knew it was good for morale. And generally, pubs were very good for morale during the war. They said, well, it was good because it was somewhere people could relax. They could, you know, talk through things with others. It was sort of like group therapy that they were having. And so that the pubs, even some of the temperance people admitted that pubs played a role that other places didn't.
Well, that's another interesting thing. So, I mean, obviously we had a big temperance movement here between the wars and Prohibition, of course. But what role did temperance play in Britain?
During World War II, pretty much none, because Churchill told them to shut up when they started complaining about food being destroyed to make alcohol. They just told them to shut up, you know, you're not helping the war effort here.
Interesting.
Well, it's the difference. I mean, for the latter war years in World War One, you had Lloyd George, who was a teetotaler prime minister. So, whereas Churchill was pretty much the exact opposite.
Interesting. Well, let's see. We haven't talked about hops. How did hop production fare during the war?
This is a really interesting one. I've got really good figures on this, which I've pulled up just so I can I can quote it properly. So basically, during the war years, right at the start of the war, there were quite considerable amounts of imports of hops.
Right.
Not as much as there'd been before World War One, but still a reasonable amount of hops, a lot of them coming from the US. Mm-hmm. These completely dried up during the war. So UK hop production was about 275,000 hundredweights all the way through the war. And what was actually used was about 225,000 hundredweights. So most years there was a surplus. The only year there wasn't one was 1944. But the way this was achieved was that they reduced the hopping rates, because one of the big disasters was December 1940, when there was an air raid that hit the warehouses in Southwark, where stupidly they'd stored most of that year's hop
crop.
And there was 30% of it destroyed in one air raid.
Wow, that's pretty substantial, I would think, right?
Yeah, and already that crop had probably been reduced just because of the problems of harvesting it, because when the harvest started, they had the Battle of Britain going on over Kent.
And was this during the Battle of Britain, summer 1940, I guess?
Yeah, the Battle of Britain was August and September 1940.
Right.
So, I mean, a lot of this was happening during the day. So they had trouble, but normally you'd get all the EastEnders would go down and that'd be their summer holiday, picking hops in Kent. But when the war was on and when there were air battles going on overhead, understandably, they had trouble persuading people to go and do it.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So they'd already had problems getting the hops harvested. And then they got a huge percentage of them destroyed.
Wow. Amazing.
And the result of that was that in June 1941, you get the government says, okay, to the brewers, you have to reduce your hopping rates by 25%.
Wow. So did that continue throughout the war?
Yeah, well, I've got, because I'm a numbers man, I've got figures for this, which I've pulled up.
Sure.
So at the start of the war, the average amount of hops per barrel was about 1 2/3 pounds a barrel, an imperial barrel, 36 gallons.
Right.
And by 1945, that was down to 1 1/3 pounds a barrel.
That's fairly low hop rates, right?
No, that's actually reasonably heavy hop rates compared to most countries. I know breweries where it's much lower than that. I know this in great detail because I've done so many of these recipes.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm just thinking about some of the IPAs we make now, which are insane amounts of pounds of hops per barrel. But
yeah, I mean, I think these are still reasonable amounts. So, right. The beers are often coming out at, I know, the bitters are well over 30 IBUs, sometimes more than 90.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, they're not. People have the wrong idea about British beer. It used to be incredibly heavily hop compared to everyone else's.
Interesting. So how did hops change later in the war as well? You mentioned the big shortage in 1940, but
well, I mean, what you see happen is that hop imports basically completely dry up in 1941.
Right.
And what you do find is that there's some hop extracts and hop products being imported from the US in the later war years. And you see these turning up in beers in 1944 and 1945. Mm-hmm. So they'll have some fairly vague about what it is, you know, sort of like hop preparation or something it's called. Normally it's about 7 to 1 as powerful as standard hops. So I guess what they were doing was rather than importing hops, which are obviously, you know, pretty bulky and not very heavy, they were importing hop preparations from the US. So makes some sense. Sort of hop concentrate.
Some kind of hop extract, I guess, right?
Yeah, and so you see these things being used last couple of years of the war and a couple of years afterwards, and then they disappear again. So as soon as that normal hop imports come in again, then people stop doing that.
And of course, ingredients weren't the only shortage. I'm guessing equipment and manpower were also, you already talked about shortage in transportation, were also a problem, right?
Yeah, I mean, shortages of loads of things, things you might not even think about, like crates. So wooden crates, because wood was in short supply, they couldn't really get any new crates. Bottles, the same thing. So before the war, in the interwar period, bottled beer had been growing in popularity the whole of the way through. Mm-hmm. And you get a bit of a break on that during World War II because it's much more difficult for them to produce bottled beer because they've got shortages of bottles. They can't get new ones. They can't get new crates. They can't get new bottling equipment. So you see a swing back to draft beer just basically because they can't produce the bottled beer. There's all these things from Bartley Perkins, the letters they sent to their publican saying, right, if you don't send us back the bottles, you're not getting any more bottled beer.
Interesting. And I assume equipment was a big problem too. I would imagine there wasn't a lot of brewery expansion going on.
Well, no, the problem is that it's not limited to just the war. It's after the war, because there are all these restrictions on materials. They couldn't import stuff very easily because the pound wasn't a hard currency. They had to have dollars to import stuff, so you had to get a license to import equipment. So people wanted to import bottling plants from other countries, but they weren't allowed to. So there's this huge gap in investment in British breweries between... certainly from the 30s right through until the early 1950s, because either they can't do it or they don't have the money to do it. And it's why a lot of the breweries sold up in the 1950s and 1960s, because they haven't had any investment for 20, 30, 40 years. Some of it not their own fault. And so this is another thing that held back bottled beer, that people would have liked to install new bottling lines, but they couldn't. For various reasons, they couldn't get permits to build the buildings because you had to have a permit to do any sort of construction. Mm-hmm. It was very heavily controlled just after World War II and also in the war years. So it really messed up breweries for a long period of time. And you see, it's only in sort of like 53, 54 when they can really start doing what they want to again.
And you mentioned manpower is in short supply, obviously.
Yeah, so obviously you had loads of people going to the front. But the thing is that the breweries didn't employ huge numbers of people. Mm-hmm. Most of probably the largest part of the workforce would have been the people in the bottling stores. Mm. Because that was the most labor-intensive part of the process. In terms of in the breweries, it's a relatively small number of people. But yeah, they suffered a bit like everyone else did because they'd lose people. And you don't seem to have seen them being replaced in the brewing jobs by women, as you might have seen in other industries. Hmm. At least I've never seen any evidence of that.
Interesting. And one thing I hadn't thought about, but coal was in short supply. I think most of these plants were steam powered, right?
Yeah, a lot of them were, or they were using, they might not have been steam powered, but they were probably using... Coal to fire the boilers,
right?
Just for the hot water. So, yeah. So that's going to take a fair amount of power. And what you see is people reduce boil times during the war, which is an obvious way of saving fuel.
And does that create any problems though?
No, not really. I mean, some of the boil times were quite long anyway. You know, people boiling for over 2 hours. I don't know why they're always doing that. I think just so it's just a hangover from what they'd always done.
And of course, demand remained high throughout the war, no small part due to the huge number of Americans that came in late in the war, right?
Yes. Well, you can see them complaining about the beer. Yeah, as soon as they arrive.
Yeah, there was. I think you said 1.5 million or something like that.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of Americans. Yeah, and so they were drinking the local beer. I think sometimes they had some American beer shipped in.
Possible, yeah.
But there's like enough stories about them drinking in pubs. Well, have you seen that wonderful public information film for the American soldiers about how to behave in a British pub?
Yeah. I haven't seen that one, but I'm sure it's entertaining.
No, it's actually really good. So it's like, don't come in and show off and throw your and brag and everything. It's not going to impress people.
Yeah.
It was actually quite good advice.
You mentioned in the war, I'm sorry, you mentioned in the book that during many periods, the beer quality may have suffered, but people kind of drank it anyways, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see sometimes the brewers weren't completely happy about what they were having to do. When they were having to put all the oats in it, I don't think many of them were very pleased. The weird thing is that for some of the London brewers, if you see the way they brewed their oatmeal stouts, it's like about 1% the most it ever was of the grist. Whereas when you look...
1% oatmeal or 1% oats, I assume?
Yeah, a really tiny percentage. Then you see during the war, they brewed some milds that might have been 15% oats. They didn't make any mention of that. So some of the recipes are real fun because you've got some weird ones. Suddenly rye appearing in some as well. So they must have had some extra rye knocking about they decided to let brewers have at one point. Hmm. I mean, it's real fun one of the things I thought about specifically for the book was partly to tell the story through the recipes. Mm-hmm. And when you follow one specific beer right through the war, and you can see how it changed in strength and how the recipe changed, it gives you a good idea about what the experience must have been like as a drinker if you see how many changes there are. I mean, I've only done one recipe for a year. For some of the beers, I could have done more because the recipe might have had two big changes within one year.
Right.
But I thought that was getting a bit much, so I've just done one for each year. But it's really interesting if you look at it, just to see the impact on a specific beer, how it had changed over the course of the war, mostly through the reasons completely out of the control of the brewer.
But you did mention also, I think, that the variety of beers available in the pubs generally declined. If you went to pick a beer, there were fewer selections in a lot of cases, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what most of the breweries did. If you look at Barclay Perkins, I think it was 1940 or 1941, they really pruned their beer range. So they went from about, I think, 10 or 11 draft beers down to about 6 or 7.
That's a significant decline. Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things that one of the beers which is the real victim of this is porter, because all the London breweries seem to discontinue their porters in 1940.
And why? You have any idea why that is specifically?
Because it.
I mean, at one time porter was wildly popular. Obviously.
Yeah. No. If you look. I've got really good figures from Whitbread because they recorded in their brewing logs how much they brewed of each of their beer each year. So I can see exactly how porter collapsed during the 20s and 30s. And by World War II, they were brewing tiny quantities of it. Mm. It was probably only out of sentiment that they kept making it. The quantities are so small. So you're talking about a brewery that's brewing 500,000 barrels a year. And they're brewing 4,000 barrels of porter.
Yeah, probably not worth it at that point, huh?
Yeah, and so that's what happens. The beers that disappeared are the strong ones because they can't afford to make them anymore. And the low-selling ones because they just can't be bothered to waste the materials on those ones anymore. So you see all the breweries, I'm going to say all breweries, but it's not true, because if you look at someone like Adnams, where they only had a small number of beers anyway, they basically keep brewing the same ones because they just have a basic range. But the London brewers, where they had quite large ranges of beers, they all really pare them down.
You talked about the hops that were bombed in 1940, but in addition to all the other chaos going on, some of the London breweries were quite literally bombed by the Luftwaffe as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a Whitbread brewing record where it says, bomb fell through fermenting room last night. quite a matter of fact, well, Whitbread, they had some quite bad damage because they'd been really clever. They realised the war was coming, and so they bought in a whole load of staves, because the oak they normally used for casks in Britain came from Memel, so the Eastern Baltic. Mm-hmm. So they realised the supply of those were likely to be interrupted, so they bought in a whole load of them, and they got them stored in the brewery yard, and they had an incendiary fall in them and burned the whole lot.
Kind of like the great toilet paper run that's going on right now, huh?
Yeah, but one that was sensible. but I've seen a photograph of the Whitbread Brewery at the end of the war, and it's standing there, and it's complete devastation around it. Virtually every building's gone, apart from the brewery, which is intact, pretty much.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
There's a reason why.
Why is that?
They all had their own fire brigades, because they had so many fires in breweries. Every large brewery in London had its own fire brigade. And because most of the damage was done from incendiaries, if you had someone putting on all the incendiary fires out, chances were, unless you were unlucky enough to have a high explosive bomb directly hit you, you were probably going to be safe. And so the big breweries in London mostly survived pretty much intact for that very reason, because they had their own fire brigades.
Interesting. How'd they do that? I mean, how did they manage to have their own fire service, I guess? Was it sponsored by the brewery?
Yeah, no, the brewery would have it, because they have the risk of fire was so great in breweries. You look in the newspaper archives, as I
did. So it was paid by the brewery then?
Yeah. They had some of their employees who were trained to handle fires.
Interesting.
But when I look in the newspaper archives, if you look at random brewery name and search through the newspaper archive, most likely thing you're going to find is a fire, either a fire or someone dying from CO2 poisoning.
Well, how did the war affect British brewing moving forward into the 50s and 60s? You've talked a little bit about it so far, but maybe just in a little more detail.
Basically, World War One, the effect that had, the lasting effect right through until when I was drinking, was afternoon closing.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, so the pubs had to close for at least 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon. They couldn't stay open from noon until late at night. You had to close in the afternoon.
And what was the rationale behind that, I guess?
I don't know. Just what happens when you get bloody temperance people in charge of licensing laws is what I would say. Huh. I don't know. I've never understood what it was. Just to be annoying, I think. It used to annoy the hell out of me. Anyway, so that was the big effect of World War One, which lasted right through until the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Whereas World War Two, it's basically just a reduction in the number of types of beer being brewed and a reduction in strengths again. And then what you find is when the strengths stabilize in the early 1950s, then it's incredible how it stays the average gravity 1037 right through until they changed the way they recorded it. So up until about 1990, it was still 1037.
So, for example, you mentioned how the beer is changing every single year. The recipes are changing every single year during the war. Do they just get locked into whatever they're brewing at the end of the war then?
Yeah, for quite a long period of time, yes. And beer strength stayed much the same. And I didn't realize this when I first started looking at the brewing history, but the period after World War II, up and through when I started drinking, is the one with the least change in the last couple of hundred years.
Interesting.
Other than the move to keg beer and lager. The normal English beer types changed remarkably little over that period of time.
And of course, you mentioned that there was a significant drop off in demand right after the war, and then all these breweries were significantly underinvested, but kind of locked into whatever they had at that point, right?
Yes. And then if you had a brewery where, especially if you didn't have a very good bottling operation, where a lot of the money after the war was in bottled beer, mm-hmm. then if you were just dependent on draft beer totally, yeah, you're probably seeing your sales fall every year by quite a bit. So, yeah, a lot of people just got out. They, you know, they weren't interested anymore. Sometimes they're like third generation brewery owners. And a lot of them were quite happy to sell up, partly because they didn't want to put the money into investing in the brewery. There's plenty of breweries like Gales. The reason they closed was that some of the equipment eventually gave up, and they weren't going to, and they hadn't invested in it for years. So when it came to a point where they had to make some big investment to keep the brewery going, it wasn't going to happen.
Was there a lot of consolidation going on at this point, or was it just breweries closing, reduction?
No, it was a lot of consolidation. But you have to see the thing is that there was always a reason to buy a brewery. You might not care about their redundant, horrible, useless brewing plant.
Mm-hmm.
What you wanted were their pubs.
Hmm. I see.
So you'd buy up other breweries mostly to get hold of their tied houses.
Interesting. So this goes back to the whole public house concept, huh?
Yeah. But it's the whole thing that you couldn't get new licenses. If you wanted to get more pubs, you had to buy them. And seeing as most of the pubs were owned by breweries, mm-hmm. the easiest way to get hold of pubs is to buy breweries.
Makes sense. Yeah.
And so that's what a lot of it's about, the consolidation. It's not about getting brands. It's not about getting breweries. It's about getting their pubs.
Interesting. So was there a significant reduction in the number of breweries then at that point?
Yeah, there's a huge reduction. I mean, I think, I can't remember correctly. I think it's about 600 breweries at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on this. I'm not completely sure. And then it was down to about, I think the low point was about 180.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, we had similar things going on in the United States. Very, very few breweries actually were left. The big breweries basically took over everything at one point.
Yeah, I mean, you had the same thing in Britain. And this is what you have happened after World War II. So you hadn't really had any big brewery mergers. Well, a couple, but not much leading up to World War II. And mostly there was sort of like, well, it's like Inkoop and Allsop, where Allsop had been sort of limping along for years. So it wasn't, they weren't sort of like really ambitious takeovers. So, but I mean, you had some of the smaller breweries selling up to the larger breweries in the 20s and 30s, but mostly not very large breweries. And you could say, yeah, it was all about the pubs again.
Well, Ron, we're coming up near the end here, but is there anything we missed about this, any major topic we missed discussing World War II beer brewing in Britain?
I'm just trying to think.
I think we covered most of the major themes anyways.
Yeah, I think so.
Where can folks learn more about it? Can you tell us?
Well, they can learn about it on my blog. I mean, I've published, Shut Up About Barclay Perkins.
Right.
If they look under the Let's Brew tag, then mm-hmm. they'll find lots of recipes that I've done, because I've been publishing quite a few examples of the recipes from the book. So,
if you want to brew an authentic World War II recipe, I guess you can go to the it's barclayperkins.blogspot.com, I think, right?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's it. But just look up Shut Up About Barclay Perkins, or just look up Ron Pattinson Beer Weirdo, and you'll probably find me.
And the book, of course, is called Blitzkrieg. When is it out yet? I'm not sure. You have these mini books that come out.
Well, you've seen the state the manuscript's in, so it needs a lot of work still.
But you do have a lot of articles from the book published on your blog, I think, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, those bits that are in the manuscript, they're probably not going to be in the finished book. They're just in a sort of like marker source material. But yeah, I've published a lot of stuff that's I've published some bits from the book on the blog, some sort of little samples of it, some bits about the different beer styles, where I go into English beer styles during World War II in ridiculous detail, splitting them up by region and stuff.
And of course, they can find your other books there as well. You've got a whole series of mini books on British brewing, right?
Yeah, well, mini books is often not really very appropriate.
Full size book. I don't know. You call them mini books.
Yeah, well, that was just when I originally started this years ago. It was my son who actually got me to do it, and I just published little things that were, you know, things from my blog. And quite small books, but
then they started growing, I guess, huh?
But over the years, they've grown into something of slightly monstrous. But
well, Ron, I really appreciate you coming on the show today. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we could get through the technical difficulties and everything. And yeah, I hope people are interested in this sort of stuff. I mean, I think the book's going to be dead interesting when I finished it. Hopefully sometime this year. I'm thinking I might drag on till VG Day rather than VE Day.
Well, we're looking forward to it, Ron. And again, appreciate being on today. My guest today was Ron Pattinson. Ron is the author of dozens of books on historical brewing, focused mostly on the UK. He runs a blog at barclayperkins.blogspot.com. Thanks again, Ron.
Okay, my pleasure.
A big thank you to Ron Pattinson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a digital brewhouse controller with high precision and the ultimate in flexibility. The Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and advanced brew day settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. Order yours today. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available for both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude beer brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from Beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.